Hello and welcome back to Render Unto Caesar, 91.3 FM CJTR Community Radio. I'm your host, Josh Campbell. Render Unto Caesar seeks to explore the connection between religion and the public sphere. The title comes from one of the more well-known events in Jesus' life, when he gets asked if a devout Jew should pay taxes to Rome. Jesus says, "Render unto Caesar what is Caesar, and unto God what is God's." Today we hear from Dr. Bridget Kahl, a German biblical scholar who impacts the life of the Apostle Paul. She claims that new insights into his life and writings may reveal just how much the greatest Christian missionary has been misunderstood. But before we get to the interview, here's a little bit about Dr. Kahl, though she prefers to be called Bridget. Bridget Kahl teaches New Testament and Bible at Union Theological Seminary in New York. A native of East Germany and a Lutheran by birth, she was ordained in the Protestant Church of Berlin-Brandenburg. She graduated from Humboldt University in Berlin, where she taught ecumenical Bible studies and New Testament until moving to the U.S. in 1998. A major focus of her work has been on critically recontextualizing Paul and Lutheran justification theology within the framework of the Roman Empire. In today's show, I asked Professor Kahl to talk about her book on Galatians, one of St. Paul's earliest writings. Commentators up to this day read Paul's criticism of the law as a condemnation of the Jewish Torah. Such a critique has likely fanned the flames of anti-Semitism throughout the centuries. But what if Paul wasn't talking about the Jewish law whatsoever, and instead was warning early Christians about compromises with Rome? Take a listen.
So the book called Galatians Reimagined, Reading with the Eyes of the Vanquished, this is a great segue for what we've been talking about. When I read this book, and I didn't read through the whole thing, but I read the first part, and then I read, of course, the couple of things you sent me. It was mind-blowing to me, Bridget, this is exactly to what we've been talking about, that what? Like, this might have been Roman law and not Jewish law that Paul was more, there's never been a suggestion of that. And when I started reading it, I said, well, this makes sense. So I was hoping that you could just explain a bit what I saw as your thesis, that Paul may have been referring to Roman law and not Jewish law in Galatians. Would you be able to sum up, I guess, some of your main points there?
This is not easy. Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying he is that, you know, law, we have to understand, Paul never says Torah. He always uses the Greek term nomos. And the Greek term nomos, sadly, really it's a problem, can mean very different things. So we never really know, unless he talks specifically about nomos as something that refers to Jewish rules, we never really know what he is talking about. And I think when we can take as an analogy, when we talk about the law, you know, what are we talking about really? The law, I mean, are we talking about the state law, or are we talking about law and order? Are we talking about a certain paragraph, or are we talking about the general order of the world? All that could be meant. And I think the order of the world at Paul's time was regulated by Roman law. And that is something we have completely forgotten when we always had this very narrow definition of law in Paul as Torah, as Jewish law. So when Paul rejects law, which he does, he is very critical of law in Galatians. We always thought, oh, he rejects Jewish law. And that led to a terrible, disastrous tradition of anti-Judaism. Because we said, oh, the key point of Paul is he is against Jewish law. He is the founder of Christianity, and Christianity is the opposite of Judaism, because the Jews have the law and we have the faith. You know, the Jews do works, and we are justified by faith alone. You know, this is the old perspective.
This makes sense given Bridget's background as a Lutheran from former East Germany, and Lutheran theology is definitely influenced by Pauline justification by faith, which she gets into, has talked about, and we'll talk about more here.
And there is again this thing why I don't know why things didn't get into the congregations. So this was challenged already in the 60s, I mean, of the last century, by people like Christel Stendhal, who said, okay, Paul does not yet talk about Christians. He never uses the term Christian. Can you imagine that? The term Christian is not a Pauline term. He talks about the community of Jews and non-Jews, which is pretty heretic at that time. I mean, you know, for a Jew who thinks they are a kind of the opposite of Gentiles, to say, well, Christ enabled us to have a new type of community with those people we thought we should reject. That can sound heretic. I admit that. But it is not yet Christianity as such. So Paul wanted to do this new universal community inside Jewish. And it's Jewish through and through. He never abandons Judaism. But he thinks he wants to transform Judaism into something that can become the receptacle of, you know, of a universal community, a global community, other than Rome. Rome was also a global community, but it was built on conquest and violence and exploitation. And Paul thought that the Messiah had initiated a new type of global community that welcomed the other, the stranger, but it was inside Judaism. So he criticizes Jewish law insofar as it prohibits this community. That's why he is against circumcision for the non-Jews. But he wants that people that are circumcised and uncircumcised. And it is a very interesting question what that would mean today. So in antiquity, uncircumcised and circumcised means two different religions, two totally different categories of people who can never coexist inside one community. And this is exactly the community Paul had in mind. People who are categorically excluded from community with us can now become part of us. That is Paul's justification theology, because we are all justified by the same act of divine grace that resurrected Jesus from the dead. So the resurrection is the impulse that gives life to a new type of community. And that is what Paul, and that is Jewish, and it confronts the Roman law, that wants every person to be categorized. I mean, you know, all of a sudden you have a mixed communities of Jews and Gentiles, and that is very messy. It messes up the order. Like if you today, you put, you know, whatever, you put, yeah, maybe evangelicals and progressives into one, or even worse, you put Christians and Muslims into one community and let them work together and see, you know, how they can do that. Something like that. And, you know, and this is the Pauline project that has never really fully been realized in history. Because what we got was Christianity, something that was, that defined itself as opposite of Judaism, rather than in community with Judaism, you know, self and other together in Christ. That was Paul's project. But then we became a Christian self, distancing ourselves from the other, of Jews and of pagans and of whatever. So this is the opposite of what Paul had in mind.
Right. So, and It's fascinating because I mean, one of the quotes that caught me from one of your papers was this concept of the ecumenism from below, and how Paul promoted this idea of an ecumenism from below that is integrated horizontally through mutual solidarity as one and otherness, as well as through the body of an executed outlaw Messiah, who in a blasphemous way is attributed all the sacrosanct titles of the emperor religion, Lord, Savior, Son of God, as well as many other terms, both political and religious connotations. So I was hoping you could, because it seems like this is where you're already talking, is this whole concept of the ecumenism from below and how this new community that Paul, and correct me if I'm wrong in understanding where you were going, Bridget, but this whole community that Paul envisioned was one that brought together people who were others and brought them together under the roof of this new Lord and Savior and Son of God, which were titles that were reserved for Caesar and now were being offered to Jesus Christ, the Messiah. And it's in that, and in that way set itself up in opposition to the state of the time. Anyways, I don't, these are just some of my things I'm trying to understand, but is that kind of what you were getting at with this idea of the ecumenism from below, or can you talk us through that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, the ecumenism from below, that is a good way to describe it. So the Roman Empire instituted an ecumenism from above. So that is, you know, the Roman Empire was a community of nations, and they were held together by jointly, all of them, worshipping the emperor as God. That, you know, you had, and we are often talking, oh, the Roman Empire was very tolerant against other religions and very syncretistic. So the problem is our categories of polytheism and monotheism don't really cover what antiquity understood religion. So there is a lot of debate that religion in our sense is a very modern invention. It didn't exist that way in antiquity. Anyway, so you had many religions, many deities in all over the Roman Empire. Each nation, conquered nation, had their own, and the Romans respected this, you know, this religious identity. This is where they were very smart. So they kind of, they didn't humiliate people by taking away their religions. They didn't missionize. But what they did is they inserted the Roman emperor into any of the given religions. So it was just like an annex to the native religions. You also worship the emperor and the goddess Romus, the emperor as god and Roma, the city, as goddess. And that kind of created a common religion that I call something like an imperial monotheism. Oh, now you have disappeared. Yeah, now you're back.
Oh, sorry.
No problem. So there was something like a common deity for all the conquered nations in the Roman Empire. So you had like an imperial monotheism that was ecumenical because it united different religions. A very interesting concept. And I think it was very powerful. This is why the Romans survived for so long, because they were very smart how they organized that. So, but then you had also polytheism. So this was imperial polytheism coexisting with imperial monotheism, you know. So that is that was Rome. And then you had an ecumenism, and you had a different concept, because what the emperor as God represented was violence, conquest, colonization, oppression, all that, and patriarchy, of course. And, you know, then you have the idea that the biblical God, and that, I think this idea could probably only come from the Jews, because they had a God who had already a track record of, you know, of opposing empires. A god who starts God's people by leading them out of Pharaoh's realm, of the house of slavery, of Egypt, you know? So the god who enters the stage of world history by, you know, by a slave rebellion against Pharaoh, right? So this god, and a god who even says, well, this is, you know, the first commandment. I am the God, Lord, your God, who led you out of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. So that is a kind of a Jewish resentment against this type of imperial divinity. And I think this is what Paul brings out when he says, okay, there is Jesus. He has been crucified by the Roman emperor as a rebel, but God has resurrected him from the dead and made him, you know, Savior, Lord, everything. And then he gives Jesus all the names that are actually, you know, reserved for the emperor. All the, this is something we usually don't think about, that Son of God, Savior, Lord, universal benefactor, whatever you think of, is all theology that has been already developed in imperial religion.
So Bridget, just to bring some context to the Galatians specifically, I found this part really interesting because I mean, I have a lot of Celtic background myself personally, so it's really.
Where are you from? Where are your ancestors from?
Yeah, mostly the Scottish Highlands and in Ireland, so kind of in those regions. So it was fascinating to me. I've always had an interest in that, and I learned a bunch about that years ago, and so this whole piece of the Galatians, the Gauls, who are the Celts, and just that history, you drew the picture of them, you know, their settlements expanding across what is now Europe and into Ankara, which is in modern day Turkey. This was a real interesting part of your work, was just, you know, you have, and again, I'm going to try to summarize what you were saying. You have within the Roman religion and politics, which is all mixed together, where they don't have a separation of church and state like we do, but you have this allowance for Jewish people to practice their traditions and practice their faith. But now you have this Paul coming along who's saying, you know, we are, there's the Gentiles who are coming in, which in this case are the Gauls, the Galatians. And this presents a problem for the early church because there isn't this exception or this allowance for non-Jews to forego, I guess, this part of the this upper ecumenism from above. There isn't an allowance for them to not participate in that. And so you say here, I'm just quoting, if the foreskin of the male Galatians has become the signifier of their political nonconformism, they should either opt for circumcision and full proselyte conversion, so join the Jews, and this is the false gospel that I think you were saying Paul's talking about, or they should return to their prior practice of civic and imperial religious observance that is expected from them as non-Jews. In other words, they should honor Caesar, honor him as Lord, Son of God, and Jesus as Lord, Son of God. This has always been tolerated and respected by the synagogue with regard to sympathetic, God-fearing Gentile adherents. These voices demand to give to God what is belongs to God's and to Caesar what belongs to Caesar. And I love that you brought that up because obviously the name of the show is Render Unto Caesar, and it's talking about that whole tribute episode. Yeah. And so I just wanted you to comment on this. You know, I've tried to sum it up, but this whole now you bring the Galatians into this, a very specific group into this story. And Can you walk us through like the dilemma that they were kind of facing, and this obviously this thing that Paul was very upset about, this false, you know, you've been bewitched into following a false gospel. Can you walk us through that?
Well, that is probably related to evil, I believe, but I think that's another. The bewitchment is an evil eye terminology. Yeah, I think the Galatians were a specific case among all the other conquered nations of Rome. So Rome conquered many nations, many ethnicities, but the Gauls were in a way a similar problem as the Jews, because they lived everywhere in the Roman Empire. So you had the Jewish diaspora, but you also had Celts everywhere. You know, they originally came from France, Switzerland, Germany, but then they went to Britain, and they were in Spain, and they then they were in Italy, and they had sacked Rome, the only people who had ever sacked Rome. This was something that was as traumatic as, you know, September 11 or storming the Capitol. I mean, you know, they actually did storm the Capitol, and the Guise saved the Capitol. So you had this narrative of the Celts are the worst enemies of the Roman Empire that ever existed, and they are also godless because they attacked Delphi, the navel of the world. So Celts are lawless, barbarian people, so in general, and they are everywhere, and you know, in Asia, and these are our Galatians, and we rarely think about that. And they had settled in Asia Minor, which is today Turkey, and they were fairly well, in a way, from what we know, they had an elite, an aristocracy that collaborated with the Romans. But we don't know about the people on the ground. Of course, they have no memories of them. But anyway, so the Celts were complicated, and the Romans really policed them, like the Jews. So I said that the Romans were very tolerant, but they had some serious problems with Jews and with Celts. So the Druids were expelled from Rome, and the Jews were expelled from Rome at the same time, for example, under Claudius, but several times. So they, you know, that was a dangerous phenomenon, again, an ecumenical phenomenon, that, you know, there was a unity that was not Roman that existed. And now, all of a sudden, with Paul, these two things come together. You have Celts that act as if they were Jews. And, you know, in a city, that there was no directly no Roman law that you have to worship the emperor. So this was, but everybody would do it. And if you don't participate in the rituals of your city, you are apparently an enemy of the city. And if you don't worship our gods, you probably, this is dangerous because the gods protect us. And the emperor, you know, if you don't worship the emperor anymore, kind of pretending that you are a Jew, so Jews are allowed to do that, but you are not a Jew, you are not circumcised, so you should participate in our religion that conveys to the Romans that we are good Roman citizens. If you are not doing that, you are endangering everybody. You are endangering the Jews, you are endangering the city, you are endangering yourself. So please come and get circumcised so that you normalize your behavior. Then you can, you don't need to worship the emperor anymore, right? But you, so that's all the first commandment, no other gods. And I think this is what drives this whole controversy. That's why I'm saying it is not just about Jewish law, but it is also about Roman law, the Roman order that expects you to behave in this way and not in this.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating. I so there was this one, the gospel of, well, the circumcision, which, you know, here's, I don't know if the gospel is the right word, but you have this option of getting circumcised. Paul condemns that. And Paul is also condemning, in a sense, this option of compromise where, well, just maintain observance of religious, imperial religious observance while you maintain your worship of Jesus. And Paul is also condemning that. Is that correct?
Not exactly. Paul is not condemning. What you are quoting is Galatians 1 and 2. So he says right at the beginning of his letter, he says, anathema against those who turn you away from the gospel that you have received and turn you to another gospel. And then he says, which is not an other gospel at all. So that is very cryptic, you know, it's very hard to understand. But what he tries to say, I think, is that if you are a Jew, of course you should be circumcised. But if you are not a Jew, you should not be circumcised. And you still can live in the same community. That is the point. So that Paul rejects the circumcision of non-Jews does not mean that he rejects Judaism. Right. But he wants to open Judaism into a new kind of ecumenical entity. And that is something that I think takes from Isaiah. It's not something he invents. It's from, you know, the light for the Gentiles, the people coming to Mount Zion and learning Torah there. So he is not against Torah, but he is just against this exclusive interpretation of Torah. Because right. He thinks the Messiah has come, and the Messiah has come for all people. And God is, of course, not the God of the Jews alone, also God of the Gentiles. This is Romans 3:29, you know. Is God a God of the Jews alone? No, of course. Never in the Bible is this assumption that God isn't a God of all peoples. So, but then Paul says, so do all the people who belong to God need to look the same? Or can we accept differences? Can we accept our otherness? And I think the Pauline communities are a school of accepting otherness, learning to accept these people we don't think are like us. That is what Paul is about. And that's why he says there is a gospel of circumcision and there is a gospel of foreskin. There are two gospels. And, you know, at the Jerusalem meeting in Galatians 2, he explains how the Jerusalem leaders saw that, you know, he says, the grace given to me. And he saw that God, in a way, authorizes Paul's proclamation. And that means that two different groups of people can learn to live together in the one community. And that is a revolutionary thing. And that is, you know, that is something where it becomes very personal, you know, it has societal implications, but it has a lot of individual implications because none of us likes to really accept those we hate.
Hello, folks, and thank you for listening to Render Unto Caesar on 91.3 FM CJTR Community Radio. I'm your host, Josh Campbell. Today I'm chatting with theologian Bridget Call about her latest book called Galatians Reimagined, Reading with the Eyes of the Vanquished. If you're just joining us now, Bridget has been explaining St. Paul's struggle to found a new universal community within Judaism. Next, she talks about Paul's encouragement to the Galatians, that they hold fast and not compromise their newfound values with Roman imperial authority. From there, I ask Bridget what modern-day applications there are for us today. And believe me, there are many.
You know, there would have been this fear amongst Galatians that, well, if I don't get circumcised, then I'm just going to compromise and I'm going to continue to practice the imperial religious observance along with my my observance of Jesus.
Yes.
Does that make sense? So
this is exactly what, you know, if we imagine ourselves to be Galatians, this is what we would discuss, the two of us. I mean, you know, the kind of why is it harmful to either get circumcised? Then we adhere to the Jewish God anyway. We also want to adhere to the Jewish law of liberation, you know, the God who leads you out of slavery. So we want to follow that law of liberation. So why then can't we get circumcised? Or the other way around, why can't we, you know, we just do our duty and we do a little sacrifice and or you just participate in a sacrifice and you eat a little bit, you know, that is a meal after the sacrifice and you participate in a meal and you get, maybe you get even some meat that you normally won't get if you are not one of the rich people. So, you know, that is an attractiveness. Emperor religion is attractive. You know, it is built on benefactions. You know, the priests make gifts to you. They give you something. So why should we reject that? And I think Paul, I believe, in Galatians has a very radical stance, a very radical stance. And I think, I don't know how I would respond if I was a Galatian, you know? If I just think of my situation in East Germany, we made compromises. You know, we did, for example, we had a ritual that was the church confirmation. You know, when you got 14, you got confirmed by the church, and you had a state ritual that was rivaling red, and you could do either or. Or you could do first the state ritual and then the church ritual. And this is what I, for example, did. My parents told me, you know, we really discussed it for a long time. And I think this, in such discussions, how much do we compromise? How much are we radical and risking everything? Then in these discussions, Paul comes alive. You know, and also we can hear the pastoral letters who are much more conservative. But I think what I'm saying is we have to hear the radical voice of Paul too, you know, and then we have to decide how we act in our contemporary challenges. And I think that is a time to be very radical, and that is a time where you might, you know, and we always make compromises. You know, it would be such a hypocritical stance to say, oh, we are the radical followers of Paul. I mean, don't even start there. But Paul in Galatians demands a lot from the Galatians. That I must admit. And we don't know whether they followed him or the circumcision preaching opponents. But we have to understand what the controversy is about, and that it's not about rejecting Judaism, which all the commentaries until today still say, oh, there is a conflict about the Jewish law. Yes, it is Jewish law, but it is Jewish law overdetermined by Roman law. You know, without the Romans, the controversy would not really exist in that way. And Paul would not have to write Galatians. So that is, so it's not only about Roman law, but I think every religious law, including our own, constantly is drawn into the orbit of imperial law. You know, we say we follow, you know, our religious law, but in reality, we follow imperial law. And that is where we have to monitor ourselves. How far do we want to follow imperial law? And what is imperial law? And I think Paul very much challenges us here to really to understand what do we do with law? I mean, our law, who is excluded by our law? How come that, you know, so many more black people are condemned by our laws here? And I mean, all these things, that is the discussion that Paul initiates about law, you know? And I think we have led a wrong discussion about the law. It's not about Torah per se, but it's Torah hijacked by Roman law. And we are hijacked by Roman law, again, I mean, or by imperial law, again, very much. And that's what we have to discuss, not what the Jews are doing. You know, we have to discuss what we are doing.
Yeah, wow, that's, so you think that, just to be clear, Paul had an issue with the Galatians who wanted to compromise in that regard?
Yes, that's exactly. And that is, and I think he, and we don't know what they talked when they were among themselves, but I think it's fascinating to imagine that he reminds them of their history and of their tribal. For example, they were tribes. At that time, they still speak their tribal languages. We know from Jerome in the 4th century that the Galatians in Asia Minor, in Turkey, still at that time speak the same tribal language that Jerome heard in Germany, in Trier. So they have still these ties, and they have tribal ties to these people that live there, which is very interesting just to imagine. And they have still a way of tribal, jurisdiction. So they have the drinometon. They still meet, and they have, like, you know, it's not over if the language is preserved. Probably also Celtic law, the Druids, the Bards, all that still exists somewhere. And we don't know how Paul would, you know, relate to that. And I think he would relate to that. We did a very interesting experiment last semester. I have a colleague who is from Senegal, West Africa, from a tribe who was very rebellious against the French missionaries and French colonialism. And we just made an experiment. And these voices are, of course, much later than Paul, but it is a situation that I think has some analogies with the situation Paul was having in Galatia. So we brought some of these voices of resistant Jola tribes in Senegal, West Africa, in dialogue with Paul. And it was very fascinating to understand that, you know, that these people probably would have a wonderful way to communicate with one another. But that is not preserved in the New Testament. So we have to, you know, that is contextualization that we have to do today in order to just to understand that if you put texts in a different context, then the normative and conservative Christian theology, they can all of a sudden open up totally surprising windows of understanding. You know, yeah. They can be read in a totally different way. And for me, the Galatians were a discovery. You know, I don't know enough about them, but, you know, just to imagine that this tribal context and the native context of these people could have an impact on how we understand Galatians. That is a very fascinating.
This is great, Bridget. I'm just coming to the end here, and I want to. I know your area of expertise is exactly in this place where we're talking. But I can only imagine, I mean, just because you're a human being living in today's world, I'm curious some of the connections you make to today. We were talking about compromises, that Paul was asking for some tough things. You mentioned your own experience growing up in East Germany. What do you think what do you think Paul is saying to particularly first world North American Christians in this regard?
Yes, I think. I think the next step is that we have to open ourselves up more radically towards the changes that we have to implement. And I think, you know, COVID is the moment where we are forced to pause and to think about where we want to go next. Do we want to go back to normal, or do we want to acknowledge that you know, that we have learned of this terrible, destructive little virus has taught us that, you know, nature can stop civilization brutally, you know? And it was comparatively probably still a mild way to teach us this lesson, but it cost millions of dead people. So, and I think we should really take in this way the radicality of Paul and say, you know, we have to think differently and we have to act differently and we have to check our alignments. You know, we are still in love with the Roman Empire. I mean, when I came here to America, I was fascinated how Roman this culture is in its architecture. You know, we have the Capitol and, you know, so many more things like that. You know, we think that the Roman Empire is our lead civilization. But if we follow that path further, it will lead us into absolute destruction. So we have to change. And that is something we can learn from Paul, to think un-Roman and to think differently. So, and I think we have to integrate. So he tries to integrate the other. And that is for us today, these are the migrants, the immigrants, not the least the climate, you know, the climate migration. We have to think what that means to us and how we deal with these people who we don't want to let in. For example, we have to, you know, then there are so many more others, but that is, climate change is coming or is happening. And I think Paul's message, when it talks about the integration of the other. So in Western thinking, the ultimate other is always the earth. You know, you have the others of women, barbarians, slaves. These are the classical others. But, you know, earth in Greek thinking is always like the summary of all three of them. Earth is a female, Gaia, and earth is enslaved. And earth is barbarian. It's a chaotic barbarian force, and you have to subdue it, right? So that is how we approach the earth. And Paul's theology of other care and other, I mean, thinking with the other and living with the other has an ecological dimension that we need to bring out. It's there in Romans 8, but I think it's everywhere when he talks about the new creation. So this is not just about human society. It has always the dimension of, you know, something that applies to animals to the earth, and in this way also to climate and things like that. So he knows that creation is a coherent system that cannot be transformed just like in one corner, but it needs to be, you know, it changes overall and not just, you know, in one piece. So we have to look at the overall picture right now. We cannot just stay in our little corners where we, you know, where we defend otherness in certain identities. We have to bring all of that together in a coherent effort to, well, to change our direction. I don't know whether we can change the planet, you know, but I think if we want to follow Paul, we have to change our direction. So that is metanoia, change of mind.
Wow, that's it's it kind of hits me in the heart when you share that, Bridget. You know, that kind of hermeneutic. It's powerful to think of those implications. One thing I wanted to share with you. One conversation that's come up a lot with my last guest, Stan Goff, who was a former U.S. soldier, was just this tie between religion and nationalism, and that
I'm reading that as we have our whole conversation, especially in the last half hour, just about these compromises. And, you know, there's such a tie between those things. It, you know, if you're a good Christian, you're a good American, right? Like this is, and it seems that the reading of Paul we're hearing is very much putting that to question, and saying, well, you know, your ultimate loyalty is to, like you said, this otherness and that openness and this kind of ecumenism from below, right? That's our allegiance. And sometimes that's going to require that we are challenged on our ecumenism from above. Yeah. And I just wanted to, you know, it's interesting, just a personal example, but I teach religion at a Catholic high school. And I had an assignment, basically we're discussing the Mosaic Law, and I love drawing connections for my, you know, they're just grade 10 sophomore high school students. And so we're talking about the Mosaic Law, and I framed it as, you know, folks, the Israelites have left Egypt, and the Mosaic Law is, it's a lot more than 10 commandments. It's many social laws that are trying to set up a society that's more equal and more just, and not repeating what it was like in Egypt. And so we talked about that, and we drew a connection to the Green New Deal today as another social contract that's being written up to, in a sense, reordinate society in a good, just way. And I brought it also to even our own city. We were voting on the budget last week, and they wanted to add another $4 million to the police budget. And I asked the students, like, is this... What do you think about this? And so a couple of my students went to council, to the city council, to give a 5-minute speech about how, you know, they think this budget should be, money should be shifted either to mental health supports or towards environmental sustainable programs. It was amazing. And it was interesting because I had, you know, the superintendent, I don't know if I'll include this part in but I had the superintendent call me and just say, you know, because the media actually covered it.
Yeah.
They talked about the story we did. This is great. I had the superintendent call me under the guise of saying, you know, hey, this is a great story that I saw in the news, but can you walk me through it? You know, I've had some people calling administration saying, why is a teacher taking students to question the police budget? And I said to her, you know, a huge part of my pedagogy is just questioning authority. Like, it doesn't mean that authority is wrong. It just needs to be questioned. And she made the comment, well, you know, the Ministry of Education is that's our boss, essentially. And I didn't make a comment, but I just thought, like, really? Like, so we are obeying, isn't the government representing the people, you know?
Yes. And what is the law? What is the law?
Yes. Yeah.
So, and that is again a poor question. I mean, that's, but I find it fascinating. And the thing of, you know, what you are saying, Paul, in a way, takes the Old Testament concept of chosen nation, God's chosen nation, and says, God's chosen nation includes the others, you know, that is the election, is there is something modified through the Christ event in the rules of who is elect and who is not. And, you know, the thing is that if you look, because you say nationalism, I think Americans have internalized the idea that they are the chosen nation. You know, that this is secular, and for me, it is mind-blowing often how deeply ingrained this pattern is. Because, you know, we have a different concept in Europe, especially in Germany, where we are very critical of our past, you know. And we have good reason to be very critical of ourselves and our past. But here in America, it is a very self-glorifying picture. That is, I think, the concept of chosenness, exactly the concept that Paul challenges. So Paul is very much really an apostle to America right now with this idea that we are above all other nations and we are, you know, entitled to do things that nobody is entitled to do and demand a bigger share of resources and of privileges than any nation in the world because we are the greatest. I mean, we are, thank God, we are beyond Trump now. But that doesn't mean that this thinking is outdated, not at all, you know, and it can come every moment, it can come back. So that chosenness is a big concept. But, you know, just I'm really fascinated. I would love to hear what you're doing in your classes. I think it must be an interesting, a very interesting way of teaching. And I think.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, Bridget. I mean, I love to try to bring these kind of implications, real world implications into the classroom. And I mean, for me, largely because of reading the work of people like you in the last couple of years, the scriptures have just come alive to me again. You know, it's just been so exciting to, scripture's really calling me to be more radical in my social action and justice behavior, and this is like the call of God on my life, you know, and in my teaching, and I mean, yeah, it's exciting. And I mean, one thing I wanted to bounce off of you, an opportunity has come up for me to possibly even get involved politically. And I'm really questioning that, you know, and I'm like, is this really a place where I can walk out my discipleship, you know, because it involves a lot of compromise. And yet my real interest is addressing some of those structural things, not just the, you know, and I wonder, can those happen in our political climate, you know, like, or is it almost just forget about it and stick to teaching, you know?
Yes. That is a fascinating question. I mean, I have made up my mind, but I'm much older than you, that teaching is my call. I mean, you know, I don't want to do anything but teaching because this is also my strength and I this is nothing else I like to do as much, but politics is important too. And we are just, you know, we are here at the brink of, you know, how much will the Green New Deal become policy, politics? And you know, it's compromise all over the place. And you know, and people are beating each other up. I mean, you know, compromising too much, or, you know, how much will the Sanders, you know, agenda will become true? I mean, you know, I believe in the Green New Deal or Thrive or whatever it is, but, you know, how much can that be? Biden is trying a lot. I mean, yeah. So that is, at least something is happening, but is it enough? So yeah. That is the question. And I think that must be, we must teach people, young people, to understand what is at stake here and that it is related to their religious background. And I think this is so much clean up work that we have to do here, detoxifying the Bible. You know, it is so in many ways so toxic and, you know, paralyzing when you go and you look at what we need to do. So, and I'm just trying to deparalyze it a little bit and detoxify.
That wraps up another edition of Render Unto Caesar on 91.3 FM CJTR Community Radio. One thing that stood out to me from this show was Dr. Bridget Call's statement that we must work to detoxify the Bible. Because it's often read from the standpoint of the privileged, the prophetic voice of change in the Bible is often missed or even outrightly denied. Join us next time when I further explore this idea with political theologians Elaine Enns and Ched Myers in their newest book called Healing Haunted Histories. Thanks for listening.